Susan and William sat and ordered a drink. The stranger was examining their clothes, their hair, their jewelry, the way they walked and sat. "Sit easily," said William under his breath. "Look as if you've worn this clothing style all your life."
"We should never have tried to escape."
"My God," said William. "He's coming over. Let me do the talking." The stranger bowed before them. There was the faintest tap of heels knocking together. Susan stiffened. That military sound, unmistakable as that certain ugly rap on your door at midnight.
"Mr. Roger Kristen," said the stranger. "You did not pull up your pant legs when you sat down."
William froze. He looked at his hands lying on either leg innocently. Susan's heart was beating swiftly.
"You've got the wrong person," said William quickly. "My name's not Chrysler."
"Kristen," corrected the stranger. "I'm William Travis," said William, "and I don't see what my pant legs have to do with you."
"Sorry."
The stranger pulled up a chair.
"Let us say I thought I knew you because you did not pull your trousers up. Everyone does. If they don't, the trousers bag quickly. I am a long way from home, Mr. Travis, and in need of company. My name is Sims."
"Mr. Sims, we appreciate your loneliness, but we're tired. We're leaving for Acapulco tomorrow."
"A charming spot. I was just there looking for some friends of mine."
"They are somewhere. I shall find them yet."
"Oh, is the lady a bit sick?"
"Good night, Mr. Sims." They started out the door, William holding Susan's arm firmly. They did not look back when Mr. Sims called.
"Oh, just one other thing!"
He paused, and then slowly spoke the words.
2155 A.D.
Susan shut her eyes and felt the earth falter under her. She kept going, into the fiery plaza, seeing nothing. They locked the door of their hotel room. And then she was crying, and they were standing in the dark, and the room tilted under them. Far away, firecrackers exploded, and there was laughter in the plaza.
"What a damned loud nerve," said William. "Him sitting there, looking us up and down like animals, smoking his damn cigarettes, drinking his drinks. I should have killed him then." His voice was nearly hysterical. "He even had the nerve to use his real name to us, the Chief of the Searchers. And the thing about my pant legs? My God, I should have pulled them up when I sat. It's an automatic gesture of this day and age. When I didn't do it, it set me off from the others. It made him think. Here's a man who never wore pants, a man used to breech uniforms and future styles. I could kill myself for giving us away.
No, no, it was my walk, these high heels. That did it. Our haircuts, so new, so fresh. Everything about us, odd and uneasy."
He turned on the light. "He's still testing us. He's not positive of us, not completely." "We can't run out on him, then. We can't make him certain. We'll go to Acapulco leisurely.
Maybe he is sure of us, but it's just playing."
"I wouldn't put it past him. He's got all the time in the world. He can dally here if he wants and bring us back to the future 60 seconds after we left it. He might keep us wondering for days, laughing at us." Susan sat on the bed, wiping the tears from her face, smelling the old smell of charcoal and incense.
"They won't make a scene, will they?"
"They won't dare. They'll have to get us alone to put us in the time machine and send us back."
"There's a solution, then," she said. "We'll never be alone. We'll always be in crowds. We'll make 1,000,000 friends, visit markets, sleep in the official palaces in each town, pay the chief of police to guard us until we find a way to kill Sims and escape, disguise ourselves in new clothes, perhaps as Mexicans.
Footsteps sounded outside their locked door. They turned out the light and undressed in silence. The footsteps went away. A door closed. Susan stood by the window looking down at the plaza in the darkness.
So that building there is a church?
Yes.
I've often wondered what a church looked like. It's been so long since anyone saw one. Can we visit it tomorrow?
Of course. Come to bed. They lay in the dark room. Half an hour later, their phone rang. She lifted the receiver.
Hello?
The rabbits may hide in the forest, said a voice, but a fox can always find them.
She replaced the receiver and lay back straight and cold in the bed. Outside, in the year 1938, a man played three tunes upon a guitar, one following another. During the night, she put her hand out and almost touched the year 2155. She felt her fingers slide over cool spaces of time, as over a corrugated surface, and she heard the insistent thump of marching feet. A million bands playing a million military tunes. And she saw the 50,000 rows of disease cultures in their aseptic glass tubes, her hand reaching out to them at her work in that huge factory in the future. The tubes of leprosy, bubonic, typhoid, tuberculosis, and then the great explosion. She saw her hand burn to a wrinkled plum, felt it recoil from a concussion so immense that the world was lifted and let fall, and all the buildings broke and people hemorrhaged and lay silent. Great volcanoes, machines, winds, avalanches slid down to silence, and she awoke, sobbing in the bed in Mexico, many years away. In the early morning, drugged with the single hour's sleep they had finally been able to obtain, they awoke to the sound of loud automobiles in the street. Susan peered down from the iron balcony at a small crowd of eight people, only now emerging, chattering, yelling, from trucks and cars with red lettering on them. A crowd of Mexicans had followed the trucks.
¿Qué pasa?
Susan called to a little boy. The boy replied. Susan turned back to her husband.
An American motion picture company, here on location.
Sounds interesting.
William was in the shower.
Let's watch them. I don't think we'd better leave today. We'll try to lull Sims. Watch the films being made. They say the primitive film make was something. Get our minds off ourselves.
Ourselves, thought Susan. For a moment, in the bright sun, she had forgotten that somewhere in the hotel, waiting, was a man smoking 1,000 cigarettes, it seemed. She saw the eight loud, happy Americans below, and wanted to call to them. Save me, hide me, help me, color my hair, my eyes, clothe me in strange clothes. I need your help. I'm from the year 2155. But the words stayed in her throat. The functionaries of Travel in Time, Inc. were not foolish. In your brain, before you left on your trip, they placed a psychological block. You could tell no one your true time or birthplace, nor could you reveal any of the future to those in the past. The past and the future must be protected from each other. Only with this psychological block were people allowed to travel unguarded through the ages. The future must be protected from any change brought about by her people traveling in the past. Even if she wanted to, with all her heart, she could not tell any of those happy people below in the plaza who she was, or what her predicament had become.
"What about breakfast?" said William.
Breakfast was being served in the immense dining room, ham and eggs for everyone. The place was full of tourists. The film people entered, all eight of them, six men and two women giggling, shoving chairs about. And Susan sat near them, feeling the warmth and protection they offered, even when Mr. Sims came down the lobby stairs, smoking his Turkish cigarette with great intensity. He nodded at them from a distance, and Susan nodded back, smiling. because he couldn't do anything to them here, in front of 8 film people and 20 other tourists.
"Those actors," said William. "Perhaps I could hire 2 of them. Say it was a joke. Dress them in our clothes, have them drive off in our car when Sims is in such a spot where he can't see their faces. If 2 people pretending to be us could lure him off for a few hours, we might make it to Mexico City. It'd take him years to find us there."
"Hey!" A fat man with liquor on his breath leaned on their table. "American tourists!" he cried. "I'm so sick of seeing Mexicans, I could kiss you!"
He shook their hands.
"Come on, eat with us. Misery loves company. I'm Misery, this is Miss Gloom, and Mr. and Mrs. Do We Hate Mexico? We all hate it, but we're here for some preliminary shots for a damn film. The rest of the crew arrives tomorrow. My name's Joe Melton. I'm a director. And if this ain't a hell of a country, funerals in the streets, people dying. Come on, move over. Join the party. Cheer us up."
Susan and William were both laughing.
"Am I funny?"
Mr. Melton asked the immediate world. "Wonderful." Susan moved over. Mr. Sims was glaring across the dining room at them. She made a face at him. Mr. Sims advanced among the tables.
"Mr. and Mrs. Travis," he called. "I thought we were breakfasting together alone."
"Sorry," said William.
"Sit down, pal," said Mr. Melton. "Any friend of theirs is a pal of mine."
Mr. Sims sat. The film people talked loudly, and while they talked, Mr. Sims said quietly, "I hope you slept well."
"Did you?"
"I'm not used to spring mattresses," replied Mr. Sims wryly. "But there are compensations. I stayed up half the night trying new cigarettes and foods. Odd. Fascinating. A whole new spectrum of sensation, these ancient vices."
"We don't know what you're talking about," said Susan.
"Always the play acting," Sims laughed. "It's no use. Nor is this stratagem of crowds. I'll get you alone soon enough. I am immensely patient."
"Say," Mr. Melton broke in, his face flushed, "is this guy giving you any trouble?"
"It's all right."
"Say the word and I'll give him the bum's rush."
Melton turned back to yell at his associates. In the laughter, Mr. Sims went on, "Let us come to the point. It took me a month of tracing you through towns and cities to find you, and all of yesterday to be sure of you. If you come with me quietly, I might be able to get you off with no punishment if you agree to go back to work on the hydrogen plus bomb."
"Science, this guy talks at breakfast," observed Mr. Melton, half-listening.
Sims went on imperturbably, "Think it over. You can't escape. If you kill me, others will follow you."
"We don't know what you're talking about."
"Stop it!" cried Sims irritably. "Use your intelligence! You know we can't let you get away with this escape. Other people in the year 2155 might get the same idea and do what you've done. We need people."
"To fight your wars," said William at last.
"Bill!"
"It's all right, Susan. We'll talk on his terms now. We can't escape."
"Excellent," said Sims. "Really, you've both been incredibly romantic, running away from your responsibilities. Running away from horror. Nonsense! Only a war."
"What are you guys talking about?" asked Mr. Melton.
Susan wanted to tell him, but you could only speak in generalities. The psychological block in your mind allowed that, generalities such as Sims and William were now discussing. "Only the war," said William. "Half the world dead of leprosy bombs."
"Nevertheless," Sims pointed out, "the inhabitants of the future resent you 2 hiding on a tropical isle, as it were,
while they drop off the cliff into hell. Death loves death, not life. Dying people love to know that others die with them. It is a comfort to learn you are not alone in the kiln, in the grave. I am the guardian of their collective resentment against you two.
Look at the guardian of resentments, said Mr. Melton to his companions.
The longer you keep me waiting, the harder it will go for you. We need you on the bomb project, Mr. Travis. Return now, no torture. Later, we'll force you to work, and after you've finished the bomb, we'll try a number of complicated new devices on you, sir.
I've a proposition, said William. I'll come back with you if my wife stays here alive, safe, away from that war.
Mr. Sims considered it.
All right. Meet me in the plaza in 10 minutes. Pick me up in your car, drive me to a deserted country spot. I'll have the travel machine pick us up there.
Bill! Susan held his arm tightly. Don't argue. He looked over at her. It's settled.
To Sims. One thing. Last night you could have gotten in our room and kidnapped us. Why didn't you?
Shall we say that I was enjoying myself?
Replied Mr. Sims languidly, sucking his new cigar.
I hate giving up this wonderful atmosphere, this sun, this vacation. I regret leaving behind the wine and the cigarettes. Oh, how I regret it.
The plaza, then, in 10 minutes.
Your wife will be protected and may stay here as long as she wishes. Say your goodbyes.
Mr. Sims arose and walked out.
There goes Mr. Big Talk,
yelled Mr. Melton at the departing gentleman. He turned and looked at Susan.
Hey, someone's crying. Breakfast's no time for people to cry. Now is it?
At 9:15, Susan stood on the balcony of their room, gazing down at the plaza. Mr. Sims was seated there, his neat legs crossed, on a delicate bronze bench. Biting the tip from a cigar, he lit it tenderly. Susan heard the throb of a motor, and far up the street, out of a garage and down the cobbled hill, slowly came William in his car. The car picked up speed. 30, now 40, now 50 miles an hour. Chickens scattered before it. Mr. Sims took off his white Panama hat and mopped his pink forehead, put his hat back on, and then saw the car. It was rushing 60 miles an hour, straight on for the plaza.
William!
Screamed Susan. The car hit the low plaza curb, thundering. It jumped up, sped across the tiles toward the green bench where Mr. Sims now dropped his cigar, shrieked, flailed his hands, and was hit by the car. His body flew up and up in the air, and down, crazily into the street. On the far side of the plaza, one front wheel broken, the car stopped. People were running. Susan went in and closed the balcony doors.
They came down the official palace steps together, arm in arm, their faces pale, at 12 noon.
Adios, senor, said the mayor behind them. Señora.
They stood in the plaza where the crowd was pointing at the blood.
Will they want to see you again?
Asked Susan.
No. We went over and over it. It was an accident. I lost control of the car. I wept for them. God knows I had to get my relief out somewhere. I felt like weeping. I hated to kill him. I never wanted to do anything like that in my life.
They won't prosecute you.
They talked about it, but no, I talked faster. They believe me. It was an accident. It's over.
Where will we go? Mexico City? Uruapan?
The car's in the repair shop. It'll be ready at 4 this afternoon. Then we'll get the hell out.
Will we be followed?
Was Sims working alone?
I don't know. We'll have a little head start on them, I think.
The film people were coming out of the hotel as they approached. Mr. Melton hurried up, scowling.
Hey, I heard what happened. Too bad. Everything okay now? Want to get your minds off it? We're doing some preliminary shots up the street. You want to watch, you're welcome. Come on, do you good.
They went. They stood on the cobbled street while the film camera was being set up. Susan looked at the road leading down and away, and the highway going to Acapulco, and the sea, past pyramids and ruins and little adobe towns with yellow walls, blue walls, purple walls, and flaming bougainvillea. And she thought, we shall take the roads, travel in clusters and crowds and markets, in lobbies, bribe police to sleep near, keep double locks, but always the crowds, never alone again, always afraid the next person who passes may be another Sims, never knowing if we've tricked and lost the searchers. And always up ahead, in the future, they'll wait for us to be brought back, waiting with their bombs to burn us and disease to rot us, and their police to tell us to roll over, turn around, jump through the hoop. And so we'll keep running through the forest, and we'll never, ever stop or sleep well again in our lives. A crowd gathered to watch the film being made, and Susan watched the crowd in the streets.
See anyone suspicious?
No. What time is it?
3 o'clock. The car should be almost ready.
The test film was finished at 3:45. They all walked down to the hotel, talking. William paused at the garage. The car will be ready at 6, he said, coming out, worried.
But no later than that?
It'll be ready, don't worry. In the hotel lobby, they looked around for other men traveling alone. Men who resembled Mr. Sims, men with new haircuts and too much cigarette smoke and cologne smell about them. But the lobby was empty. Going up the stairs, Mr. Melton said,
Well, it's been a long, hard day. Who'd like to put a header on it? You folks? Martini? Beer?
Maybe one. The whole crowd pushed into Mr. Melton's room, and the drinking began.
Watch the time, said William.
Time, thought Susan. If only they had time. All she wanted was to sit in the plaza all of a long, bright day in October, with not a worry or a thought, with the sun on her face and arms, her eyes closed, smiling at the warmth, and never move. Just sleep in the Mexican sun, and sleep warmly and easily and slowly and happily for many, many days. Mr. Melton opened the champagne.
To a very beautiful lady, lovely enough for films, he said, toasting Susan. I might even give you a test.
She laughed.
I mean it, said Melton. You're very nice. I could make you a movie star.
And take me to Hollywood?
Cried Susan.
Get the hell out of Mexico, sure.
Susan glanced at William, and he lifted an eyebrow and nodded. It would be a change of scene, clothing, locale, name, perhaps. And they would be traveling with 8 other people, a good shield against any interference from the future.
It sounds wonderful, said Susan.
She was feeling the champagne now. The afternoon was slipping by. The party was whirling about her. She felt safe and good and alive and truly happy for the first time in many years.
What kind of film would my wife be good for? Asked William, refilling his glass.
Melton appraised Susan. The party stopped laughing and listened.
Well, I'd like to do a story of suspense, said Melton. A story of a man and wife like yourselves.
Go on.
Sort of a war story, maybe,
said the director, examining the color of his drink against the sunlight. Susan and William waited.
A story about a man and wife who live in a little house on a little street in the year 2155, maybe, said Melton. This is ad lib, understand, but this man and wife are faced with a terrible war. Super plus hydrogen bombs, censorship, death in that year, and, here's the gimmick, they escape into the past, followed by a man who they think is evil, but who is only trying to show them what their duty is.
William dropped his glass to the floor. Mr. Melton continued.
And this couple take refuge with a group of film people, whom they learn to trust. Safety in numbers, they say to themselves.
Susan felt herself slip down into a chair. Everyone was watching the director. He took a little sip of wine.
Ah, that's a fine wine. Well, this man and woman, it seems, don't realize how important they are to the future. The man especially is the keystone to a new bomb metal. So the searchers, let's call them, spare no trouble or expense to find, capture, and take home the man and wife once they get them totally alone in a hotel room where no one can see. Strategy. The searchers work alone, or in groups of eight. One trick or another will do it. Don't you think it would make a wonderful film, Susan? Don't you, Bill?
He finished his drink. Susan sat with her eyes straight ahead of her.
Have a drink, said Mr. Milton.
William's gun was out and fired three times, and one of the men fell, and the others ran forward. Susan screamed. A hand was clamped to her mouth. Now the gun was on the floor, and William was struggling, held. Mr. Melton said,
"Please!"
standing there where he had stood, blood showing on his fingers.
"Let's not make matters worse."
Someone pounded on the hall door.
"Let me in!"
"The manager," said Mr. Melton dryly.
He jerked his head.
"Everyone, let's move!"
"Let me in! I'll call the police!"
Susan and William looked at each other quickly, and then at the door.
"The manager wishes to come in," said Mr. Melton. "Quick!"
A camera was carried forward. From it shot a blue light which encompassed the room instantly. It widened out, and the people of the party vanished, one by one.
"Quickly!"
Outside the window, in the instant before she vanished, Susan saw the green land and the purple and yellow and blue and crimson walls and the cobbles flowing down like a river. A man upon a burro, riding into the warm hills, a boy drinking orange crush. She could feel the sweet liquid in her throat. A man standing under a cool plaza tree with a guitar. She could feel her hand upon the strings, and, far away, the sea. The blue and tender sea. She could feel it roll her over and take her in. And then she was gone. Her husband was gone. The door burst wide open. The manager and his staff rushed in. The room was empty.
"But they were just here. I saw them come in, and now—"
"Gone!"
cried the manager.
"The windows are covered with iron grating. They couldn't get out that way."
In the late afternoon, the priest was summoned, and they opened the room again and aired it out, and had him sprinkle holy water through each corner and give it his blessing.
"What shall we do with these?"
asked the charwoman. She pointed to the closet, where there were 67 bottles of chartreuse, cognac, creme de cacao, absinthe, vermouth, tequila, 106 cartons of Turkish cigarettes, and 198 yellow boxes of 50-cent pure Havana filler cigars. The Visitor. Saul Williams awoke to the still morning. He looked wearily out of his tent and thought about how far away Earth was. Millions of miles, he thought. But then what could you do about it? Your lungs were full of the blood rust. You coughed all the time. Saul arose this particular morning at 7 o'clock. He was a tall man, lean, thinned by his illness. It was a quiet morning on Mars, with the Dead Sea bottom flat and silent, no wind on it. The sun was clear and cool in the empty sky. He washed his face and ate breakfast. After that, he wanted very much to be back on Earth. During the day, he tried every way that it was possible to be in New York City. Sometimes, if he sat right and held his hands a certain way, he did it. He could almost smell New York. Most of the time, though, it was impossible. Later in the morning, Saul tried to die. He lay on the sand and told his heart to stop. It continued beating. He imagined himself leaping from a cliff or cutting his wrists, but laughed to himself. He knew he lacked the nerve for either act. "Maybe if I squeeze tight and think about it enough, I'll just sleep and never wake," he thought. He tried it. An hour later, he awoke with a mouthful of blood. He got up and spat it out and felt very sorry for himself. This blood rust, it filled your mouth and your nose. It ran from your ears, your fingernails, and it took a year to kill you. The only cure was shoving you in a rocket and shooting you out to exile on Mars. There was no known cure on Earth, and remaining there would contaminate and kill others. So here he was, bleeding all the time, and lonely. Saul's eyes narrowed. In the distance, by an ancient city ruin, he saw another man lying on a filthy blanket. When Saul walked up, the man on the blanket stirred weakly.
"Hello, Saul," he said.
"Another morning," said Saul.
"Christ, I'm lonely." "It is an affliction of the rusted ones," said the man on the blanket, not moving,
very pale and as if he might vanish if you touched him.
"I wish to God," said Saul, looking down at the man, "that you could at least talk. Why is it that intellectuals never get the blood rust and come up here?" "It is a conspiracy against you, Saul," said the man, shutting his eyes, too weary to keep them open. "Once I had the strength to be an intellectual. Now it's a job to think." "If only we could talk," said Saul Williams.
The other man merely shrugged indifferently.
"Come tomorrow. Perhaps I'll have enough strength to talk about Aristotle then. I'll try. Really, I will."
The man sank down under the worn tree. He opened one eye.
"Remember? Once we did talk on Aristotle, 6 months ago, on that good day I had."
"I remember," said Saul, not listening. He looked at the Dead Sea.
"I wish I were as sick as you.
Then maybe I wouldn't worry about being an intellectual. Then maybe I'd get some peace."
"You'll get just as bad as I am now in about 6 months,"
said the dying man.
"Then you won't care about anything but sleep and more sleep. Sleep will be like a woman to you. You'll always go back to her because she's fresh and good and faithful, and she always treats you kindly and the same. You only wake up so you can think about going back to sleep. It's a nice thought."
The man's voice was a bare whisper. Now it stopped and a light breathing took over. Saul walked off. Along the shores of the Dead Sea, like so many emptied bottles flung up by some long-gone wave, were the huddled bodies of sleeping men. Saul could see them all down the curve of the empty sea, One, two, three, all of them sleeping alone, most of them worse off than he, each with his little cache of food. Each grown into himself, because social converse was weakening and sleep was good. At first there had been a few nights around mutual campfires, and they had all talked about Earth. That was the only thing they talked about. Earth and the way the waters ran in town creeks, and what homemade strawberry pie tasted like, and how New York looked in the early morning coming over on the Jersey ferry in the salt wind. I want Earth, thought Saul. I want it so bad it hurts. I want something I can never have again. And they all want it, and it hurts them not to have it. More than food or a woman or anything, I just want Earth. This sickness puts women away forever. They're not things to be wanted. But Earth, yes, that's a thing for the mind and not the weak body. The bright metal flashed on the sky. Saul looked up. The bright metal flashed again. A minute later, the rocket landed on the sea bottom. A valve opened. A man stepped out, carrying his luggage with him. Two other men in protective germicide suits accompanied him, bringing out vast cases of food, setting up a tent for him. Another minute, and the rocket returned to the sky. The exile stood alone. Saul began to run. He hadn't run in weeks, and it was very tiring, but he ran and yelled, "Hello! Hello!" The young man looked Saul up and down when he arrived.
"Hello. So this is Mars. My name's Leonard Mark.
I'm Saul Williams." They shook hands. Leonard Mark was very young, only 18. Very blonde, pink-faced, blue-eyed, and fresh in spite of his illness.
"How are things in New York?" said Saul.
"Like this," said Leonard Mark, and he looked at Saul.
New York grew up out of the desert, made of stone and filled with March winds. Neons exploded in electric color. Yellow taxis glided in a still night. Bridges rose and tugs chanted in the midnight harbors. Curtains rose on spangled musicals. Saul put his hands to his head, violently.
"Hold on! Hold on!" he cried. "What's happening to me? What's wrong with me? I'm going crazy!"
Leaves sprouted from trees in Central Park, green and new. On the pathway, Saul strolled along, smelling the air.
Stop it, you fool!"
Saul shouted at himself. He pressed his forehead with his hands.
"This can't be!"
"It is," said Leonard Mark.
The New York towers faded. Mars returned. Saul stood on the empty sea bottom, staring limply at the young newcomer.
"You,"
he said, putting his hand out to Leonard Mark.
"You did it. You did it with your mind."
"Yes,"
said Leonard Mark. Silently they stood facing each other. Finally, trembling, Saul seized the other exile's hand and wrung it again and again, saying,
"Oh, but I'm glad you're here. You can't know how glad I am."
They drank their rich brown coffee from the tin cups. It was high noon. They had been talking all through the warm morning time.
"And this ability of yours?"
said Saul over his cup, looking steadily at the young Leonard Mark.
"It's just something I was born with," said Mark, looking into his drink. "My mother was in the blow-up of London back in 57. I was born 10 months later. I don't know what you'd call my ability. Telepathy and thought transference, I suppose. I used to have an act. I traveled all around the world. Leonard Mark, the mental marvel," they said on the billboards. "I was pretty well off. Most people thought I was a charlatan. You know what people think of theatrical folks. Only I knew I was really genuine. But I didn't let anybody know. It was safer not to let it get around too much. Oh, a few of my close friends knew about my real ability. I had a lot of talents that will come in handy now that I'm here on Mars.
You sure scared the hell out of me, said Saul, his cup rigid in his hand. When New York came right up out of the ground that way, I thought I was insane.
It's a form of hypnotism which affects all the sensual organs at once. Eyes, ears, nose, mouth, skin, all of them. What would you like to be doing now, most of all?
Saul put down his cup. He tried to hold his hands very steady. He wet his lips.
I'd like to be in a little creek I used to swim in Millintown, Illinois, when I was a kid. I'd like to be stark naked and swimming.
Well, said Leonard Mark, and moved his head ever so little. Saul fell back on the sand, his eyes shut. Leonard Mark sat watching him. Saul lay on the sand. From time to time his hands moved, twitched excitedly, his mouth spasmed open, sounds issued from his tightening and relaxing throat. Saul began to make slow movements of his arms, out and back, gasping with his head to one side, his arms going and coming slowly on the warm air, stirring the yellow sand under him, his body turning slowly over. Leonard Mark quietly finished his coffee. While he drank, he kept his eyes on the moving, whispering Saul lying there on the dead sea bottom.
All right, said Leonard Mark.
Saul sat up, rubbing his face. After a moment, he told Leonard Mark,
I saw the creek. I ran along the bank, and I took off my clothes,
he said breathlessly, his smile incredulous.
And I dived in and swam around.
I'm pleased, said Leonard Mark.
Here!
Saul reached into his pocket and drew forth his last bar of chocolate.
This is for you.
What's this?
Leonard Mark looked at the gift.
Chocolate? Nonsense. I'm not doing this for pay. I'm doing it because it makes you happy.
Put that thing back in your pocket before I turn it into a rattlesnake and it bites you.
Thank you, thank you.
Saul put it away.
You don't know how good that water was.
He fetched the coffee pot.
More?
Pouring the coffee, Saul shut his eyes a moment. I've got Socrates here, he thought. Socrates and Plato and Nietzsche and Schopenhauer. This man, by his talk, is a genius. By his talent, he's incredible. Think of the long, easy days and the cool nights of talk we'll have. It won't be a bad year at all, not half. He spilled the coffee.
What's wrong?
Nothing.
Saul himself was confused, startled.
We'll be in Greece, he thought, in Athens. We'll be in Rome, if we want, when we study the Roman writers. We'll stand in the Parthenon and the Acropolis. It won't be just talk, but it'll be a place to be, besides. This man can do it. He has the power to do it. When we talk the plays of Racine, he can make a stage and players and all of it for me. By Christ, this is better than life ever was. How much better to be sick and here than well on earth without these abilities? How many people have ever seen a Greek drama played in a Greek amphitheater in the year 31 B.C.? And if I ask, quietly and earnestly, will this man take on the aspect of Schopenhauer and Darwin and Bergson and all the other thoughtful men of the ages? Yes, why not? To sit and talk with Nietzsche in person. With Plato himself.
There was only one thing wrong. Saul felt himself swaying. The other men. The other sick ones along the bottom of this dead sea. In the distance, men were moving, walking toward them. They had seen the rocket flash, land, dislodge a passenger. Now they were coming slowly, painfully, to greet the new arrival. Saul was cold.
"Look," he said. "Mark, I think we'd better head for the mountains."
"Why?"
"See those men coming? Some of them are insane."
"Really?"
"Yes."
"Isolation and all make them that way?"
"Yes, that's it. We'd better get going."
"They don't look very dangerous. They move slowly."
"You'd be surprised."
Mark looked at Saul. "You're trembling. Why's that?"
"There's no time to talk," said Saul, getting up swiftly. "Come on, don't you realize what'll happen once they discover your talent? They'll fight over you. They'll kill each other. Kill you. For the right to own you."
"Oh, but I don't belong to anybody," said Leonard Mark. He looked at Saul. "No, not even you."
Saul jerked his head.
"I didn't even think of that."
"Didn't you now?" Mark laughed.
"We haven't time to argue,"
answered Saul, eyes blinking, cheeks blazing.
"Come on."
"I don't want to. I'm going to sit right here until those men show up. You're a little too possessive. My life's my own." Saul felt an ugliness in himself. His face began to twist.
"You heard what I said!"
"How very quickly you changed from a friend to an enemy," observed Mark. Saul hit him. It was a neat, quick blow coming down. Mark ducked aside, laughing. "No, you don't." They were in the center of Times Square. Cars roared, hooting, upon them. Buildings plunged up, hot, into the blue air.
"It's a lie!"
cried Saul, staggering under the visual impact.
"For God's sake, don't, Mark! The men are coming! You'll be killed!"
Mark sat there on the pavement, laughing at his joke. "Let them come. I can fool them all." New York distracted Saul. It was meant to distract, meant to keep his attention with its unholy beauty after so many months away from it. Instead of attacking Mark, he could only stand drinking in the alien but familiar scene. He shut his eyes.
"No,"
and fell forward, dragging Mark with him. Horns screamed in his ears. Brakes hissed and caught violently. He smashed at Mark's chin.
Silence.
Mark lay on the sea bottom. Taking the unconscious man in his arms, Saul began to run heavily. New York was gone. There was only the wide soundlessness of the Dead Sea. The men were closing in around him. He headed for the hills with his precious cargo, with New York and green country and fresh springs and old friends held in his arms. He fell once and struggled up. He did not stop running. Night filled the cave. The wind wandered in and out, tugging at the small fire, scattering ashes. Mark opened his eyes. He was tied with ropes and leaning against the dry wall of the cave, facing the fire. Saul put another stick on the fire, glancing now and again with a cat-like nervousness at the cave entrance.
"You're a fool,"
Saul started.
"Yes,"
said Mark.
"You're a fool. They'll find us. If they have to hunt for 6 months, they'll find us. They saw New York at a distance like a mirage, and us in the center of it. It's too much to think they won't be curious and follow our trail."
"I'll move on with you then,"
said Saul, staring into the fire.
"And they'll come after."
"Shut up!"
Mark smiled.
"Is that the way to speak to your wife?"
"You heard me!"
"Oh, a fine marriage this is. Your greed and my mental ability. What do you want to see now? Shall I show you a few more of your childhood scenes?"
Saul felt the sweat coming out on his brow. He didn't know if the man was joking or not.
"Yes,"
he said. "All right," said Mark. Watch. Flame gushed out of the rocks. Sulfur choked him. Pits of brimstone exploded. Concussions rocked the cave. Heaving up, Saul coughed and blundered, burned, withered by hell. Hell went away. The cave returned. Mark was laughing. Saul stood over him.
You, he said coldly, bending down. What else do you expect? Cried Mark. To be tied up, toted off, made the intellectual bride of a man insane with loneliness? Do you think I enjoy this?
I'll untie you if you promise not to run away.
I couldn't promise that. I'm a free agent. I don't belong to anybody.
Saul got down on his knees.
But you've got to belong. Do you hear? You've got to belong. I can't let you go away.
My dear fellow, the more you say things like that, the more remote I am. If you'd had any sense and done things intelligently, we'd have been friends. I'd have been glad to do you these little hypnotic favors. After all, they're no trouble for me to conjure up. Fun, really. But you've botched it. You wanted me all to yourself. You were afraid the others would take me away from you. Oh, how mistaken you were. I have enough power to keep them all happy. You could have shared me like a community kitchen. I'd have felt quite like a god among children, being kind, doing favors in return for which you might bring me little gifts, special tidbits of food.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Saul cried. But I know those men too well.
Are you any different?
Hardly.
Go out and see if they're coming. I thought I heard a noise. Saul ran. In the cave entrance, he cupped his hands, peering down into the night-filled gully. Dim shapes stirred. Was it only the wind blowing the roving clumps of weeds? He began to tremble, a fine, aching tremble.
I don't see anything.
He came back into an empty cave. He stared at the fireplace.
Mark!
Mark was gone. There was nothing but the cave, filled with boulders. Stones, pebbles, the lonely fire flickering, the wind sighing, and Saul standing there, incredulous and numb.
Mark! Mark! Come back!
The man had worked free of his bonds slowly, carefully, and using the ruse of imagining he heard other men approaching, had gone where? The cave was deep, but ended in a blank wall, and Mark could not have slipped past him into the night. How, then? Saul stepped around the fire. He drew his knife and approached a large boulder that stood against the cave wall. Smiling, he pressed the knife against the boulder. Smiling, he tapped the knife there. Then he drew his knife back to plunge it into the boulder.
Stop!
Shouted Mark. The boulder vanished. Mark was there. Saul suspended his knife. The fire played on his cheeks. His eyes were quite insane.
It didn't work, he whispered.
He reached down and put his hands on Mark's throat and closed his fingers. Mark said nothing, but moved uneasily in the grip, his eyes ironic, telling things to Saul that Saul knew. If you kill me, the eyes said, where will all your dreams be? If you kill me, where will all the streams and brook trout be? Kill me, kill Plato, kill Aristotle, kill Einstein. Yes, kill all of us. Go ahead, strangle me, I dare you. Saul's fingers released the throat. Shadows moved into the cave mouth. Both men turned their heads. The other men were there, five of them, haggard with travel, panting, waiting in the outer rim of light.
Good evening, called Mark, laughing. Come in, gentlemen.
By dawn the arguments and ferocity still continued. Mark sat among the glaring men, rubbing his wrists, newly released from his bonds. he created a mahogany-paneled conference hall and a marble table at which they all sat, ridiculously bearded, evil-smelling, sweating and greedy men, eyes bent upon their treasure. "The way to settle it," said Mark at last, "is for each of you to have certain hours of certain days for appointments with me. I'll treat you all equally. I'll be city property, free to come and go. That's fair enough. As for Saul here, he's on probation. When he's proved he can be a civil person once more, I'll give him a treatment or two. Until that time, I'll have nothing more to do with him." The other exiles grinned at Saul.
"I'm sorry," Saul said. "I didn't know what I was doing."
"I'm all right now." "We'll see," said Mark. "Let's give ourselves a month, shall we?" The other men grinned at Saul. Saul said nothing. He sat staring at the floor of the cave. "Let's see now," said Mark. "On Mondays it's your day, Smith." Smith nodded. "On Tuesdays I'll take Peter there for an hour or so." Peter nodded. "On Wednesdays I'll finish up with Johnson, Holtzman, and Jim here." The last three men looked at each other. "The rest of the week I'm to be left strictly alone, do you hear?" Mark told them. "A little should be better than nothing. If you don't obey, I won't perform at all."
"Maybe we'll make you perform," said Johnson.
He caught the other man's eye.
"Look, we're five against his one. We can make him do anything we want. If we cooperate, we've got a great thing here."
"Don't be idiots," Mark warned the other men.
"Let me talk," said Johnson. "He's telling us what he'll do. Why don't we tell him? Are we bigger than him or not? And him threatening not to perform. Well, just let me get a sliver of wood under his toenails and maybe burn his fingers a bit with a steel file, and we'll see if he performs. Why shouldn't we have performances, I want to know, every night in the week?"
"Don't listen to him," said Mark. "He's crazy. He can't be depended on. You know what he'll do, don't you? He'll get you all off guard, one by one, and kill you. Yes, kill all of you, so that when he's done, he'll be alone. Just him and me, that's his sort." The listening men blinked, first at Mark, then at Johnson. "For that matter," observed Mark, "none of you can trust the others. This is a fool's conference. The minute your back is turned, one of the other men will murder you. I dare say, at the week's end, you'll all be dead or dying." A cold wind blew into the mahogany room. It began to dissolve and became a cave once more. Mark was tired of his joke. The marble table splashed and rained and evaporated. The men gazed suspiciously at each other with little bright animal eyes. What was spoken was true. They saw each other in the days to come, surprising one another, killing, until that last lucky one remained to enjoy the intellectual treasure that walked among them. Saul watched them and felt alone and disquieted. Once you have made a mistake, how hard to admit your wrongness, to go back, start fresh. They were all wrong. They had been lost a long time. Now they were worse than lost. "And to make matters very bad," said Mark at last, "one of you has a gun. All the rest of you have only knives, but one of you, I know, has a gun." Everybody jumped up. "Search," said Mark. "Find the one with the gun, or you're all dead." That did it. The men plunged wildly about, not knowing whom to search first. Their hands grappled, they cried out, and Mark watched them in contempt. Johnson fell back, feeling in his jacket. "All right," he said. "We might as well have it over now. Here, you, Smith!" And he shot Smith through the chest. Smith fell. The other men yelled. They broke apart. Johnson aimed and fired twice more.
Stop!
Cried Mark. New York soared up around them, out of rock and cave and sky. Sun glinted on high towers. The elevated thundered tugs blew in the harbor. The green lady stared across the bay, a torch in her hand.
Look, you fools, said Mark.
Central Park broke out constellations of spring blossoms. The wind blew fresh-cut lawn smells over them in a wave, and in the center of New York, bewildered, the men stumbled. Johnson fired his gun three times more. Saul ran forward. He crashed against Johnson, bore him down, wrenched the gun away. It fired again. The men stopped milling. They stood. Saul lay across Johnson. They ceased struggling. There was a terrible silence. The men stood watching. New York sank down into the sea. With a hissing, bubbling, sighing, with a cry of ruined metal and old time, the great structures leaned, warped, flowed, collapsed. Mark stood among the buildings. Then, like a building, a neat red hole drilled into his chest, wordless, he fell. Saul lay staring at the men, at the body. He got up, the gun in his hand. Johnson did not move, was afraid to move. They all shut their eyes and opened them again, thinking that by so doing they might reanimate the man who lay before them. The cave was cold. Saul stood up and looked remotely at the gun in his hand. He took it and threw it far out over the valley and did not watch it fall. They looked down at the body as if they could not believe it. Saul bent down and took hold of the limp hand.
Leonard,
he said softly.
Leonard.
He shook the hand.
Leonard.
Leonard Mark did not move. His eyes were shut. His chest had ceased going up and down. He was getting cold. Saul got up.
We've killed him,
he said, not looking at the men. His mouth was filling with a raw liquor now.
The only one we didn't want to kill, we killed.
He put his shaking hand to his eyes. The other men stood waiting.
Get a spade, said Saul. Bury him.
He turned away.
I'll have nothing to do with you.
Somebody walked off to find a spade. Saul was so weak he couldn't move. His legs were grown into the earth with roots feeding deep of loneliness and fear and the cold of the night.